Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, my guest is Sam Farr, the member of the United States House of Representatives, whose districts include Monterey and Santa Cruz counties on the south central coast of California. Today we'll talk about the access that the Democrats have as the minority party to the microphone in Congress. We'll also discuss the 9/11 Commission and its investigation, the Patriot Act, the upcoming Democratic and Republican national conventions, and the election this fall, and the usual book question. This interview was recorded by phone on Sunday morning, April 11th, 2004. Sam Farr, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry. It's great to be on your program once again.
Sam, let's talk about the your comment last time we spoke was that the Democrats don't have access to the microphone or don't have a voice in Congress. Has that changed?
It's not changed, but it's not as problematic as it has been. That is to say that we don't have a choice. We don't have a microphone because we don't have any control of the Senate. We don't have any control of the House, and we certainly don't have any control of the White House. Those are the leadership of each of those organizations is in the Republican hands, and they control the agenda. They control what is said, what is heard, what is debated, and you know the Democrats can't even reserve a room in the Capitol without permission from the Republicans. I mean, they own the building. So, in essence, that's where we've been shut off. But what's happened is that the public is just so outraged by what's going on in this country, both foreign and domestic, that it's doing what's happening is the way it's supposed to happen. It's kind of a bottoms-up organization, which is where the party needs to be if it wants to win the election. It can't buy this election. It can't It doesn't have the money to do it. It can't compete on equal terms with the Republicans and all their resources. But it's
you're talking about the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And in that is the same thing as trying to win back the majority in the Senate and win back the House. And that's where Democrats are concentrating is on the key races. There's probably 20 to 30 races in the country that are possible of swinging from a Democrat to Republican or vice versa, and so
that's within races within the House of Representatives.
Every single 435 member of the House is up for re-election. Some members are retiring, so those are open seats, and the rest are incumbents running for re-election. And out of those 435 seats, there's only about 20 that will swing.
And by swing, you mean that can go either way, whereas the other 415 are really set. They're safe districts for one party or another.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, in your area, Mike Thompson, the Democrat, and, well, you have the seat that Doug Ossie was in the northern Sacramento area, and that he was retiring. So that seat is what they call an open seat. I know Dan Lundgren won the Republican primary. But that's a seat that, you know, normally people think by registration and voter performance is a Republican seat. So that's not one of those seats that's in play nationally.
Are there enough seats that are in play nationally to make it possible for the Democrats to take control of the House?
Absolutely, in both the House and the Senate.
Even the change that took place in Texas, where there would be five new Republican seats based on the reapportionment that was approved by the Texas legislature last spring.
Well, that's what's going on in this country that is so insidious, is the Republican leadership in Congress. Tom DeLay is essentially has a mission to change the structure of representational politics in America to make it impossible for the Democrats to ever have a majority in the House and the Senate by not changing it in these races, but changing it in the state legislatures and the reapportionment. So the districts will be drawn under safe lines, and obviously Texas is the one that everybody's looked at, but it's happening in other states as well, and it makes it very difficult. We've had, out of the Texas delegation, the majority of which are Democrats, one of the Democrats in this reapportioned seat just threw in the towel. He couldn't win in his new district, and he's retiring. And all the other six others who were in really difficult seats running against incumbent Republicans or prominently known Republicans in Texas, those Democrats all feel that they can win their races.
Be interesting to see how that comes out.
Yeah, if we win those races after this insidious reapportionment, I think it's I think the voters in Texas will have done this country a big favor.
Well, let's talk about Iraq. The Sunday edition, Sunday, April 11th edition of the New York Times says that the United States is preparing a prolonged drive to suppress the uprisings in Iraq. What do you see from the congressional perspective with regard to what is happening in Iraq now?
Well, there's two things going on. One is the oversight of the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction, which is primarily the 9/11 Commission and the follow-up of that. That's what's going on in Congress is oversight missions. Even in the day-to-day activities in Iraq, we have a lot of members of Congress that go over there. And unfortunately, you know, we get to speak to Iraqis because of the security issues are pretty much, encased with our own military representation and that of the other countries that are there. But they get a feeling on the ground, get a feeling of it, and then come back and have oversight hearings. I think Senator Kennedy last week put it right to point, saying that Iraq is going to be George Bush's Vietnam.
But how will that affect the election next November, in your perspective?
Well, I think it's the number one issue. The number one issue is always the economy and jobs at home and just how people feel about the economy. It seems to be over time that's what their people go to the polls for. But without a doubt, Iraq's got to be number two. And I don't see anything getting better. The question is, you can't just pull out, sort of leave to religious slaughters that might go on, ethnic cleansing that we've seen happen. And so I think we have a responsibility, but I don't think the responsibility has to be ours alone. We certainly need to go back to the U.N. I don't think this president's going to be able to do that. He kind of snubbed the U.N. He said he was going to Iraq alone and didn't care whether the U.N. went with him or not. And now to come in and ask for help, I think he's first got to apologize for the way he treated the United Nations. But if certainly Senator Kerry has pointed out that that's the first thing he would do, and perhaps under a new administration, with a new voice, you'd have new friendships being adhered to, and Iraq. The thing, Barry, is you know, as a returned Peace Corps volunteer, we don't have anything. And I've carried legislation on this to create a post-conflict reconstruction process in the United States, essentially setting up kind of a FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. Whenever we have a national disaster, we know how to respond, regardless of what the disaster is, whether it's a flood or fire or drought or freeze or whatever. Earthquake, we know how to get the right people at the right place at the right time who are sensitive to what's going on the ground. We don't have that, and when we can win a war, but the minute the war's over, whether it was in Bosnia or Afghanistan or even Haiti, where we've been to twice now, we don't know how to put everything back together. And we need an international cadre of people who are linguistically capable and culturally capable of going into these countries. And unfortunately, they didn't have a plan for post-Iraq because, as the president told this nation, they're going to be dancing in the streets and hugging us, and we won't have to rebuild Iraq. They'll do it themselves. Well, here we are.
That didn't quite happen a year later.
No.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Congressman Sam Farr, who represents the South Central Coast of California, based in Salinas and Santa Cruz. He is the congressman from that district in the House of Representatives. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sam, Let's talk about the upcoming national conventions. How do you see them unfolding? First, the Democrats in Boston, and then a month later, the Republicans in New York City.
Well, first of all, Barry, what you're seeing right now is the president and the National Republican Committee is trying to win the presidential election between now and the conventions. They would like to so dis-Kerry that the conventions are irrelevant, that the polls will show the president so far ahead, and they have this, you know, $150 million, more than any candidate's ever had in history, to spend between now and the conventions, and they're doing that. We're not seeing those ads so much in California because this isn't a state that's in play, but those swing states that make the difference in electoral college votes are being heavily advertised negative campaigning against Kerry. So it's interesting because there's sort of this game plan before the conventions that we've never seen before. And it's going to make this election year a very, very long election year. And the conventions will just be sort of, it might even be so boring by the time the convention starts that the people will be turning it off and turning away because they're just sick and tired of the negative campaigning. But nonetheless, that's what seems to be happening now. The Democrats are in Boston, and you know, Massachusetts is probably the most liberal state in the nation. All of their representatives in Congress and the Senate are Democrats. Certainly has a lot of, you know, if this is going to be sort of a patriotic year, it's the beginnings of the American Revolution and all that. And so I think the Democrats, and we've never had a convention there, it's going to be very interesting. The Republicans, on the other hand, just were so assured that they could seize the 9/11 and the attack on the Twin Towers that they could reenact the post 9/11 ceremonies with the firefighters and local law enforcement, first responders, and sort of capture and wrap themselves in the flag of patriotism. And I don't know whether that may be backfiring a little bit.
Or unraveling, considering that there seems to be some information that there were some memos to the president in the president's daily briefing of August 6th, 2001, indicating that there was a great deal of Al-Qaeda activity in the United States and that they may even use airplanes.
Well, it's interesting. Everybody was kind of dissing this 9/11 commission as not having a prominent enough personalities, but I think the commission has certainly put itself into the public limelight with all the testimony both behind closed doors and in public and television and the controversy that was around Condoleezza Rice's testimony and certainly Clark's testimony. The world is now waiting anxiously for this report. The commissioners say that they're going to have a unanimous report, and I hope, because we have some serious people on there who don't want to know their role in history, that they're going to come up with a substantive report making recommendations to Congress of how things can change. But mostly that will be not debating the facts of this, but will be recommending to Congress sort of institutional changes, procedural things that ought to more coordination between agencies and so on. We're all now, rather than getting caught up in the personalities, looking forward to to what the commission is going to be recommending.
Well, if they're not going to dispute the facts, does that indicate to you that they're going to be pretty clear on the facts, assuming that the president knew certain things in August or prior?
Well, I think what they'll do is point out what's wrong, what's broken that needs fixing. These agencies have information, they're not sharing it with the agencies that need to know, that there's been these firewalls that these agencies have built, and these firewalls have got to come down. If they're sharing intelligence, they've got to be much more forthright with it. I mean, the problem isn't the lack of information. Congress has always heard ever since this, when we started looking at it, it's information overload. I mean, our intelligence agencies and intelligence agencies around the world know just about every piece of information that you can imagine. The difficulty is, how do you separate what is routine from that which is not routine? And remember, the terrorists don't have any sophisticated equipment to be able to secure their conversations or their communications. They use the internet, and they use ordinary ways of, that the rest of us just communicate. And yet, they're able to figure out or code that in a sense that people haven't picked it up as well as they should have. So these are things I think the commission's going to be recommending: is how do we get the left hand to talk to the right hand.
In some sense, the Patriot Act is an attempt to do that. Do you have any comments on how the Patriot Act actually does get into the daily business and private lives of?
Well, I'm not sure if we even know. I mean, members of Congress know, but we know certainly on the legal procedures and it's taken away a lot of rights. I'm adamantly opposed to it. Adamantly opposed to this sort of Patriot Act II that being talked about. It hasn't been introduced, but nonetheless, there's a lot of discussion out there that they're going to come in with an upgrade of Patriot Act I. I think it's dead on arrival in election year. We've got to be smarter about how we do security, but we shouldn't do it at the cost of our individual freedoms and of what is the essence of American democracy, which is this this public transparency of government activities.
Where would you begin to make government activities opaque? At what point should the citizens not be able to see what the government is doing?
Well, I can't, for the life of me right now, just think of something. But I'm sure that there's some pieces of information that are sensitive. I think my friends on the Intelligence Committee, who can't tell us what they do, they almost laugh about it because they say, well, we can't tell you, but go read the papers. It's in the papers. So I think they make a lot of information more secure than they need to. But that's just Sam Farr talking.
That's the House Intelligence Committee, where you go into a private room and the committee staff members will show you what's available, but they swear the House member to secrecy, and you can't take any of the documents out of the room?
Well, there's two things. We have a House Intelligence Committee. It's a select committee, and people sit on it for a term and rotate off, and new members come on. And they meet almost daily. They have a room in the Capitol that's secured. You have to go in and give up your pager, give up your cell phone, anything like that. Now, any member of Congress can go in and read any of the documents they have. They can't go in and sit in the hearings where they actually have, fact-finding hearings, unless you're a member of the Intelligence Committee. But we can go read any of the documents, but you have to go through the same procedure, and you have to sign all kinds of papers saying you're not going to disclose anything you've read in there.
But assuming a member were to choose to disclose what they've read and discuss it on the House floor, what would be the sanctions that would befall that member?
Well, there's House rules that you would be censored by your colleagues, and if the censor is extreme, they could kick you out of Congress. But that's never happened. But I'll tell you, the funny thing is that every year Barney Frank has an amendment to the intelligence appropriations amount, which is never discloses how much money we're appropriating. And the First Amendment was always to disclose what it is, which is debated and defeated every time. And then as a sort of a poke of, poking a stick at all of us, he says, whatever it is, the Second Amendment, whatever it is, cut it by a dollar. And that amendment loses too, isn't it? But usually the New York Times or Washington Post knows what the amounts, the billions of dollars that we're spending on intelligence. We have, numerous intelligence agencies, not just the Central Intelligence Agency, but national security agencies, and each of the military services has their own intelligence agencies, and so do law enforcement. So I think what you're going to see the commission doing is that these intelligence agencies ought to be getting together. They're just as they operate independently, just as independently as the rest of government operates.
What would you surmise would be the source of the leak if the New York Times has this information?
There's a lot of people involved in putting this information together and presenting on the Hill, both written and testimony-wise, and who knows. It's the biggest scandal we've had so far is the leak was given in right after 9/11 on the intelligence they got, which they thought compromised some intelligence officers, and it's become is a Republican senator who leaked information that was classified.
And what information was that?
It was essentially how they gathered information, what they knew, and therefore by saying what you knew, and you knew who gave it to you, and that's where it compromised individuals in the field.
In other words, it was procedural information as opposed to substantive information?
Both.
And that was dealing with what came from Niger that Iraq allegedly had?
No, that was separate as what happened there. That wasn't the senator's disclosure. I forget all the facts around the incident, but that actually was, remember the president told the nation that that was the source of, that they had the capability of selling this plutonium. And as we found out, the ambassador at the time indicated that that wasn't true. And then so they outed the ambassador's wife, who was an undercover agent. And that has been scandalous in the intelligence world. And the White House is you know, they're trying to find out who exactly in the White House did that.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious, and I know you know the next question, which is, tell us about an interesting book that you've been reading lately.
Well, Barry, first of all, I think your question about the book is always one of the more exciting reasons this program is so good, because I wish other interviewers would sort of ask you about what you're curious about or what your hobbies are, and you do that so well. The book that I'm just telling everybody they got to read is called The Two Americas, and it's out, just recently out. It's written by a fellow named Stanley Greenberg. Stanley Greenberg was Clinton's pollster, and he's a professional pollster and is doing polling not only all over the United States but all over the world, a very reputable pollster. And he is married to Rosa DeLauro, who is a congresswoman from Connecticut and one of our Democratic congressional leaders in the House. And Stanley Greenberg's book essentially points out that America is kind of culturally divided right down the middle. A culture that, on one hand, is very supportive of big business, of the right to bear arms, of the anti-abortionists. On the other hand, the other culture is supportive of labor, supportive of government's right to regulate guns, and supportive of choice, women's right to choose. And so these cultures are essentially voting the former on the Republican side, and where you bring over a lot of people in that area is the white Southern male, and the latter, which is chance to vote Democrat, and where you get the crossover there are sort of the soccer moms or are moderate Republican women who vote with the Democrats. And that how close it is, and gives the history of this culture through the history of this country, and really points out that we're really at a closer crossroads than we've ever been, and that's why this election is so key, and it's down to essentially a block by block campaigning in about 16 different states that could swing the electoral votes, as we saw in the last election. Al Gore got the most populist votes. And in fact, if there's six states where the majority of the U.S. population lives in, so if all those six states voted the same way, you'd have the majority of the vote of America, but you'd have 44 states that didn't agree with the choice. That's why you have the Electoral College, which has one delegate for each congressional district. And they, in the end, can choose, as we saw. And the battles, obviously, the big electoral college states are Florida, Ohio. But out here in the West, New Mexico, Arizona, Oregon have been in play. You're going to see this national campaign so carried out on almost a precinct level in these states. And we will be exporting a lot of workers from California to other states. And I have a lot of friends who are already signing up to go to states. But Stanley Greenberg's book just lays it out better than I've ever seen it, and I think people will really begin to understand the American politic by reading it. And I hope your listeners will get a chance to take a look at that book.
If somebody wants to sign up to go work in the presidential campaign, how would they do that?
Well, they'd contact the Kerry campaign or the National Democratic Committee, which is headquartered in Washington, and just either by mail or email or go to a website. So you have three national committees. You have the National Senate Campaign Committee, the National Congressional Campaign Committee, which is the campaign committee for the House, and then you have the National Party, which is essentially the campaign committee for the presidential election, the National Democratic Committee. And each of those has websites and has how you can sign up in different activities. I'd like to add that the Republican structure is the same. They have a National Senate Committee, National House Committee, and a National Party Committee. It mirrors what the Democrats have. Obviously, I'm more interested in getting help for the Democratic side of the aisle than the Republican side of the aisle. They've got all the money, and we have to counter that with the workers.
Congressman Sam Farr, thank you again for joining us on Radio Curious, as you do from time to time.
You're very welcome, Barry, and thank you for putting this program on. I think it's very helpful to have people understand what's going on in this country.
Sam Farr is a member of the House of Representatives from Carmel, California. His district includes Monterey and Santa Cruz counties on the south central coast of California. The book that Sam Farr recommends is Two Americas by Stanley Greenberg. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10. We appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs here at Radio Curious, and our address is Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Join us again next week.